Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Last Wednesday, I had the privilege of UC Berkeley asking me to give what they call a public lecture. And it was called 8 Career Truths That May Not Be So True. And last Sunday on this show, I kind of gave a little preview of what that was going to be like. And I talked about the first 4 of those 8. And listener response was they wanted to hear the other 4. So ever responsive to you, my dear listeners' needs, that's where we're going to start. We're going to talk about the kind of try to maybe even do a better job of presenting those other 4 than I did at my UC Berkeley presentation Wednesday, although it did go very well. I was really gratified that the dean came up to me afterwards and says, "We'll get in touch with you soon about more engagements," S on the end, so I was pleased with that. Okay, in any case, one of the other 4 that I didn't talk about that is a career ostensible truism that in my judgment requires more nuance is the notion that job seekers must sell themselves. I used to accept that unquestioningly. You know, it's after all, it's kind of the American way. You know, market, market, market. If you're marketing any product, let alone yourself. And when I got trained as a career counselor, I went to conferences as a career counselor, we were always taught new and ever more powerful tools to help our clients sell themselves. We, of course, learned about PAR stories. Make sure you've got these really compelling stories that you can tell people about a problem you solved at work and the very clever or dogged way that you approached it, and then the amazing resolution where you saved the company $9 zillion. I'm fond of saying that if we added up all of the ostensible savings that job applicants saved their employers, it would exceed the gross domestic product. Any case, we were taught stuff like that. We were taught to microanalyze mock video interviews, really looking at every little thing they do in terms of how much they're leaning forward, how high they're elevating their chin. President Obama uses that. Whenever he's making a controversial point, he raises his chin just slightly to appear more confident. All these little microanalytic video tools to help the job applicant make the very best possible impression. Of course, we were taught to train them to have perfect canned answers for the toughest interview questions. By the way, before I go on, I've been reading over the last 2 months a really dramatic change in interviewing techniques that employers are using because they're sick and tired of getting snowed by all of the canned answers because they can't tell the difference between a well-prepared applicant who's been coached to the max or a really good applicant. So there is a dramatic change that I've noticed in the increase in the number of use of simulation questions. Put yourself in this situation. It's not something you did in the past because that can be coached. You know, you can prepare that. But they give you a simulation of what you need to do on the job, and they have you do it. And that has the side benefit not only being extremely valid, but it is least likely to be objected to as an unfair question because it is clearly job related. But I digress. In any case, we as career counselors were trained, you know, that it might be okay to write their resumes for their clients or write their cover letters or write their thank you letters. The notion is the core principle is job seekers must sell themselves. But after a while, I started feeling oily. What about the job applicants who chose to do their own work? I mean, imagine how you would feel if you did your own work and in applying for a job and you lost out to somebody who was a less good candidate who paid some hired gun to write their cover letter or write their application or write their thank you letter. And from a more, you know, egalitarian liberal perspective, would that be fair to candidates who don't have the money to hire a hired gun? And they need the money in the job more than somebody who's can afford to hire the hired gun. Was I, as a career counselor, putting shine on less qualified applicants? and thereby I'm hurting the chances of more qualified people. If I was doing my job well, and the clients then got an interview from my writing their resume and their cover letter and all that stuff, and then so they had kind of this leg up. They're kind of like they had a jetpack on for the first part of the job search. So they started out with a big lead over other applicants. And let's say then my clients there, you know, got the job. Was I also hurting the employer, who's now saddled with a worse employee than if it weren't for my work? And weren't the coworkers at that workplace similarly saddled with a less good, I don't like to use the word inferior, it's not a politically correct term these days, but a less good employee than they otherwise would have? You think about yourself, isn't it feel great to have coworkers who you can really rely on, who are smart and hardworking and low maintenance? And if a worse person is hired, doesn't that mean, at least in some small way, that the products or services that the organization provides are more likely to be worse? Right? Because after all, you're hired to create better products, services, more efficient processes, whatever. And if a less good candidate is hired because of Marty Nemco's efforts to sell the client, aren't in turn products and services that the organization provides, and could be nonprofit, it could be, you know, tutoring to inner city kids. But if they're hiring less good people, there's less quality provided. And thus, in turn, is not society worse? I mean, I had become a career counselor to make things better. Was I fooling myself? Was I actually making things worse? So there is this notion of job seekers must sell themselves, and my job as a career counselor to help them do that. But I've now, you know, I haven't radically changed my position, but I've taken a more nuanced position. There is nothing wrong, in fact, there's everything right about helping someone find a well-suited career. That's something I certainly do as a career counselor. There's certainly everything right about helping someone who's already on the job to become more successful and happy on that job or in life. But it is striking me that there is something wrong with helping a job applicant to look better than they are. And the weaker the applicant, the more that feels wrong. And it's the weaker applicants who, on average, are the ones who are more likely to seek, you know, to say, well, it's really worth the money. I'm afraid I'm not going to get the job, so it's worth the money. I'm going to go and hire this hired gun. So, yeah, I mean, to be honest, I still do help my clients try to land a job, but I really do only help those that I can feel like I can honestly champion for the jobs to which they aspire. And as you might have inferred from my previous statement, I've become especially reluctant to write or even heavily edit anyone's resume. I mean, employers don't just use a resume to read about a candidate's work history. For any, at least for white-collar job, professional jobs, employers use a resume to compare candidates on how well they think, how well they organize their thoughts, how well they write, how well they can produce an error-free document. If I, as a career counselor, write or even significantly edit someone's resume, that employer is going to get an inflated estimate of how well that candidate thinks, how well that candidate organizes, how well that candidate writes, and how detail-oriented that candidate is. I mean, really, think about it. If writing someone else's resume were ethical, why don't I, or any resume writer, write on the resume written by Marty Nemco, professional resume writer? I mean, think about it. If you, think of just yourself, if you were to hire a resume writer, how many of you would want the resume writer to write on it, written by Jane Jones, professional resume writer? So the takeaway for you, my dear listeners, is I invite you to think twice when you're deciding whether you should do your own work, write your own resume, your cover letters, your thank you letters, whatever, or you should hire a hired gun. So what do I say to a client who wants me to help them land a job? I do. I turn away a lot of prospective clients, about half. That's not true. Maybe a quarter. If I sense that they would be a liability in the workplaces that they want to work in and they're not open to anything else. But most often, I don't turn away clients. About 80% of the time, I would say. What I simply try to do is I try to help them realize that, quote, selling themselves is not the right metaphor. You can sell yourself into a job if you're slick enough, you get enough coaching. Absolutely. But if it's not the right job, you're going to likely do poorly. You may get fired, you may get laid off, and you're going to be back to see me. And, of course, you won't feel good about yourself. It seems to me that the right metaphor for job seeking is not selling it's matchmaking. In matchmaking, you're honestly revealing your strengths and your weaknesses, and the wrong employers are going to reject you, and the right one, or a right one, is going to hire you. For example, like one of my weaknesses, I've said this before on the show, I'm a terrible team player. Terrible. If I were applying for a job, I would mention that. I would say, well, yes, I am capable of doing difficult projects on my own, but I do terribly on a team. I get frustrated when I don't get enough control. I need to be in charge. That's who I am. I can't fix that. I'd be very frustrated. By being that honest, I'll mention my strengths, absolutely, but by bringing up my weaknesses, and anyway, I won't go any further, that would get me rejected from the wrong jobs, and it would get me accepted for one where my strengths are valued. And also, as a side little benefit, the employer, who usually is, you know, girded to see whether what you're writing is BS or true, because there's so much creative writing that goes on in applications. If I'm openly revealing a true weakness, not the crap that's always touted like, well, my greatest weakness is that I tend to try too hard. Give me a break. I mean, even if it's true, employers just think of that as a canned phrase. But if I am honestly revealing a weakness that would not otherwise normally be disclosed by an applicant, that applicant is, the employer is much more likely to trust what I'm saying in the rest of my application and interview is honest. So, again, the takeaway for you, I'm inviting you to consider. The next time you are looking for a job, try to think of it not as selling, but matchmaking. All right, I want to share the others in a few minutes, but I first want to give you a chance to respond to that. Do you think I am being too high-minded and asking too much of the human condition to ask people who may be desperate for a job, desperate to support their families, for me to urge this integrity thing that you should be focusing on strength, you're presenting your strengths and weaknesses, focusing on trying to facilitate the match between you and employer rather than the American way of sell, 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 market, market, market yourself? Am I being too high-minded? Am I being unrealistic? Or is this a worthy position to take? I'm curious what you think. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Now, for those of you just joining us, this is Work with Marty Nemko, and I am talking about, I gave a speech Wednesday with what UC Berkeley calls a public address, where the public is invited to come, and it's a kind of a community relations thing. And my topic was 8 career truths that may not be so true. Last week, I shared 4 of them in preparation for that speech, and the listeners, I got a lot of positive feedback and people saying they'd like me to share the other 4, so that's what I'm doing now. Okay, so another of the so-called career truths that I have some second thoughts about and like to think that I have developed a more nuanced position around is the notion that you will make a bigger difference if you work for a nonprofit or for government than if you work for a company. And I did feel that way. I mean, after all, I went to Berkeley, and I spent 6.5 years there getting my master's and PhD. And I've been living in the Bay Area for 40 years now. I listen to KELW. I'm on KELW. I've gotten that message that, you know, in general, all things being equal, corporations are less worthy entities than nonprofits or government work. But I have had a few eye-opening experiences that have made me question that. And beyond my anecdotal personal experiences, as I'm going to mention in a minute or two, I've done a little broader thinking about it, and my current thinking is more nuanced. It's not that I'm saying nonprofits are bad, companies are good. I'm not saying government is bad. You know, government is bad. Government is good, and corporations are bad. But I'm more agnostic. I'm more actually celebratory of diversity in this issue. And first of all, those eye-opening experiences, and I have mentioned these on the show, but it's so germane. And I use them in my speech, so I want to share them again with you. I'm assuming most of you are not exactly listening for every week for the last 24 years. But it's a really vivid, vivid memory for me. I recall visiting the federal buildings in Oakland, you know, those twin skyscrapers downtown, and I was walking through the hall, and this wasn't just one desk or two desks or 4 desks. There was like 20 desks. And I saw clean desk after clean desk. So this is not one little anecdotal thing. This is clean desk after clean desk with employee after employee literally polishing their nails or reading a magazine. That's just very vivid for me in terms of when I think about, you know, can we really say that government work is that much more worthy, or that certainly that the taxpayer is getting value for the dollars? Then there was a call to this very radio show, and I have talked about this before, but again, for those of you who have not heard it, this caller asked me, you know, he's very frustrated. He says he supervises construction workers, painters, carpenters, etc. For the San Francisco. And he was very frustrated at how slowly they would work. And he tried to get him to work faster. And he came back to his car one day, and they had slit his tires with a note on it saying, don't push us, or something like that. And in that same call, he said that often, I don't know about always, but I don't remember. It's been a long time ago. It was about a number of years ago. He said that the crews have so little work to do that they would do stuff like they would build a fence very slowly and then knock it down and build it again so they could look busy. So that made me start to wonder whether the conventional wisdom that I had been, you know, inculcated with living in the Bay Area for so long, that kind of does value government over corporations in general, maybe was that as true as I had been led to believe? And I did spend 6.5 years at Berkeley. You can't spend 6.5 years at Berkeley without feeling that corporations are not as good net as nonprofits and government agencies. And then regarding nonprofits, I mean, I've had over 4,000 clients, and being a career counselor here in the Bay Area, you get a really significant percentage of my clients do work for nonprofits. And I can't, again, I'm not saying a majority, but a number of them, and it's kind of very vivid in my mind, have told me how frustrated they are with the inefficiency of the nonprofit. And I remember one person telling me she feels guilty asking people to donate to the nonprofit because so much of it does get, I don't know if I'm allowed to use the word, just say wasted. And of course, it's wasted in every sector. And when I think about companies, yes, I am aware of their pollution. I'm aware of their being all about the bottom line. I'm worrying about, you know, their duplicity and saying people are our most important product. I'm aware of the negatives. But I'm wondering if net companies are not worse than the government sector or the nonprofit sector, but, you know, and that whether job seekers and many people here in the Bay Area. You know, many of my clients come to me and they say they only want to work for a nonprofit. They only want to work for the government. They don't want to work for a company. I'm wondering whether a more full dimension look might open people. I'm not asking you to work for a tobacco company. I wouldn't work for a tobacco company if they made me $10 million, gave me $10 million. But a company is not a company is not a company. It's like a restaurant is not a restaurant. A restaurant is not a restaurant. You know, there are some restaurants that are overpriced, crappy nouvelle food which is noisy, and I wouldn't go there in a million years. And there's others, like my favorite Indian restaurant, Allspice, in American Canyon, which is the most delicious, fabulous, well-priced, if not fancy food. And I, you know, that's fantastic. Restaurants are not all alike. Is that not true of companies? So think about the company that made the radio that you are listening to right now, or maybe if you're listening on the computer. You can buy a really good-sounding radio for $30, $20, I don't know. And they're made by corporations, by Sony or General Electric or television. I remember as a little boy, I grew up and we had like a 13-inch black-and-white screen, and it cost hundreds of dollars back then. Now, you can go and get a 32-inch TV in color, and it costs about $200. Can we really say that, you know, the companies that make those TVs, I don't know, you know, JVC or, you know, Panasonic or whatever, that those are evil? When they make, you know, speaking in liberal terms, poor people, working class people can afford a television set. They can afford a computer. I can buy a really reliable, basic Dell computer for $300. That's the price of a pair of sneakers. Google. I mean, Google, think about a corporation. They're a big corporation. They have 15,000 workers. They have profits, shareholders, the whole corporate deal. Well, they make the information of the world available to everyone for free. The great equalizer. Even if you're dirt poor, you can walk into a library and get the access of the information of the world. We couldn't contemplate it 30 years ago. Is working for a Google intrinsically inferior to working for a nonprofit or a government agency? Or, as I said, those electronic companies that make TVs and radios. What about Toyota? I drive a Prius. My Prius has 216,000 miles on it. It has had, wait, I've replaced one water pump in 216,000. Other than that, all I just changed the oil. No tune-ups, no nothing. And it gets 45 miles a gallon and is low pollution. Can we say Toyota is working for Toyota is more evil than working for a government agency or a nonprofit? Bear. You know, as we get older, I take a baby aspirin every day, and they show that it reduces. I've never had a heart attack. Thank God I'm very healthy. But, you know, they say at my age, you know, when you get over 50 or whatever, and intense like I tend to be, a baby aspirin can reduce your risk of heart attack 30%. And I can take that Bear. Bear's got a bigger operation right here in Berkeley. And I get take a dose of that baby aspirin. Costs pennies per dose, like 3 cents or something. Can we say that working for Bear is inferior to working for a nonprofit? Whirlpool. Whirlpool made my refrigerator. It cost me $900. I mean, you know, I didn't spend on some big, you know, French door refrigerator cost $3,000 or whatever. But you can buy a perfectly good 21-foot refrigerator by Whirlpool that is totally reliable. Cost me $900 15 years ago, and it still runs perfectly. Can we say that working for Whirlpool is less justifiable than working for a nonprofit or government agency? I own a home. A corporate home builder built my house at a price that I couldn't afford if I hired handy people to do it. Now, even, and this is like something that is near and dear to many people as a defendant, as anti-corporate view, corporate food. I can go into Trader Joe's or another supermarket, very pleasant place with music in the background and very nice, and I can buy a pound of on-the-vine tomatoes for $2. If I do what is the, quote, nonprofit way, and I go to the farmer's market. I went to the Rockridge Farmer's Market recently. They want $2.50 per tomato. Even if I thought it was worth it, and I can afford it, but can poor people, can we really criticize, quote, corporate food? When it's, isn't it quite elitist for us to say that we should shun and make people feel guilty for buying corporate food, $2 a pound tomatoes, but instead send them to the farmer's market where their precious few dollars, poor people's precious few dollars, have to pay $2.50 for a tomato? Let's leave it open-ended. My point simply is that we tend, at least, and remember that my topic here is 8 career truths that may not be so true. This notion among many folks that they will only work for a nonprofit or a government agency because they're the, quote, good guys. I'm merely encouraging more nuance. That, in fact, there is good and evil, or not about evil, but let's say good and less good in all sectors. So I invite you to look on a case-by-case basis for deciding where you're going to work. The good news is that could expand your options so much more than if you're just looking narrowly, because the Bay Area conventional wisdom among many people is, yes, only nonprofit, only government work. So the competition for a nonprofit job is enormous. Everybody wants to be an environmentalist. And so if you want to work for a Sun company or a nonprofit advocacy group, there are hundreds of applicants for every job, unless it's a, you know, highly technical job with super advanced computer expertise. But if it's your typical, you know, advocate job, writing job, organizational skills job, whatever, if they place an ad, they're going to get hundreds of applicants, and they're going to pay almost nothing because they've got hundreds of applicants. They don't have to pay a lot of money. And they'll expect you, not always, but more often than not, in that nonprofit, because there are 9,000 people waiting in the wings, they will expect you to work long hours for that little money. And they'll say, well, don't you believe in the cause? So I merely invite nuance here. For you, everybody's a separate person. Some people really just hate the word profit. They hate corporations, and they won't work for one, and that's fine. But I am just encouraging you to at least give a little thought to the conventional wisdom of the, quote, truism that you will make a bigger difference by working for a nonprofit or government than for a company. So I do invite you to call. If you agree or disagree, I've shared so far two of the four career truths that I hadn't mentioned last week that I used in my presentation and my speech at UC Berkeley Wednesday. This one is that you'll, you know, the question of whether you will make a bigger difference working for a nonprofit or government than for the private sector. And the other, that job seekers must sell themselves. And I've argued that the more appropriate metaphor, both for yourself as well as for society, is think of yourself as helping in the matchmaking process rather than selling them. Phone number here, work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. The third of the four so-called career truths that I like to think are worthy of a second look is that we should strive for work-life balance. But we have callers on the line, so I'll hold off on that. I'm going to take a balanced look at the question of whether we should strive for work-life balance. But let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hi, it's you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I appreciate what you're saying about keeping people open to their options, and I appreciate what you're saying about a more nuanced look. But on the other hand, I do have to say that your comments about the private and public sector go far beyond a nuanced view. I've worked in the not-for-profit sector for 25 years, and there's three points I'd just like to make to that, not to counter, but to supplement what you're saying about that sector. First of all, the not-for-profit sector has an accountability for waste efficiency that the private sector lacks. So when people very simplistically point to flaws or deficiencies in the not-for-profit sector in contrast to the corporate, the reason that comes up is that we care about it, we're accountable for it, and we do something about it. In the private sector, there's less accountability. You just pay for your mistakes. You don't care if you make mistakes. You correct it through the market and through your pricing. Secondly, moving into the private sector is extremely difficult for people who have had a not-for-profit career, and that might be a point you might want to address on the air, because even though skills are transferable, and not-for-profits often make the error, in my view, of assuming that a corporate background is somehow a magic skill set, and moving from the private to the public sector is an easy path. Moving from the public to the private sector is not so easy, and that might be something that you could assist your listeners with in trying to overcome that kind of bias. But I do think that the blanket kind of character assassination I heard earlier of not-for-profit waste and inefficiency is really off target. And again, I think it's because we are accountable, we care about these things, we have public scrutiny, and we can't simply up our prices to cover our mistakes.
I thank you for the call. I will respond to each of those points. The reason that I presented the other side, that is the fact that the arguments that corporations are not so evil, is that in trying to provide balance to the conventional wisdom, for me to make the advocacy statements for nonprofits or government would not provide that balance, and certainly in the interest of time on the radio show, it would have been certainly a waste of time. Would not do anything to try to balance the anti-corporate bias for me to talk about that. And I can't be more nuanced than to have reiterated three or four or five times that I'm merely asking people, in light of this counterbalancing statement, for people to be more more open-minded about their choices. With regard to, it was ironic that he said that I was being broad brush, but he made the most broad brush statement imaginable by saying that nonprofits are interested in countering inefficiencies, but private sectors don't care. In fact, private sector people do, you know, they are very, you know, because they are worried about inefficiency. People lose their job if the bottom line is not met. And that's what efficiency is about. They just can't indiscriminately raise prices. Whereas nonprofits, I don't think there's an intrinsic difference between nonprofits' desire to be efficient. It's just in general, the kind of people who are profit oriented and therefore work in nonprofits tend to value the notion of efficiency more than nonprofits that are more driven by cause than by efficiency. So if I had to bet, that all things being equal, and while there's tremendous overlap, that on average there is greater efficiency in the for-profit sector. And indeed, I am certainly not the only one who has criticized, who has opined that on average, nonprofits tend to be less efficient than for-profits. And his third point is one that is certainly worth discussing. The difficulty of moving from the for-profit sector to the nonprofit and vice versa. Indeed, nonprofits are very critical of people who are in the for-profit sector because they feel there is a different culture, a different valuing, and they don't trust that the more collaborative, consensus-building, less profit-centric mindset that's required in the nonprofit sector will exist in many for-profit people. So there's an a priori distrust. There's similar distrust on the other end. If you have, like this caller, had 25 years working in the nonprofit sector, a company is going to worry that indeed your mindset as a nonprofit person is going to be dissonant with the, yes, more efficiency on average orientation and for-profit orientation, and usually less consensus-oriented, somewhat faster-paced decision-making in the for-profit sector. So there is, I think, legitimate reason for employers on both sides to prefer people who have a track record in their own sectors. In other words, if I am the owner of a business, I'm more likely, when I get dozens of applicants for a position, to view as a point in an applicant's favor if they have worked in similar organizations. If I'm a hiring manager in a corporation and the person spent a lot of time in corporations, I get a sense that they're probably pretty happy in that environment. If I'm working in a nonprofit, I'm a manager in a nonprofit, it's a point in an applicant's favor if he or she has spent many years in the nonprofit sector. It leads me to believe that that person is more comfortable. It's like no graduate school, like in physical therapy, is going to let somebody go into physical therapy school unless they've had some experience working in physical therapy clinics or working in physical therapy, because they have a sense that that person has got, you know, has experienced it and likes it. So anyway, those are my best reactions to the caller. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hello.
Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, this is Zoe Hosion from San Francisco.
Hi.
A long time now, I'm going to move me and my cat because there's echoing.
Okay.
For a long time now, I have viewed both performance levels of corporate structure and, quote, nonprofit structure. And as a member of the class of 72, and I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, I had to enter as a blind female in the private sector to be employed at all. I gained wonderful experience, so on and so forth. But these days, I see little difference at the top of the food chain between either one. I see six figures and above being handed to the top of the food chain at the corporate level. There are privileges and perks and appointments and friends, shall we say, on both sides. And so I'm happy and proud that some private sectors, let's say Scripps Institute, couldn't get the funding from the government to put water markers in the oceans on our side of the globe to test global warming. And they could get it from private sector. Well, someone in the room at the Commonwealth Club was very upset about the private sector contributing money because they thought it was going to be controlled anyway. And I, in thinking about that past experience, which was recent, I'm more inclined to agree with her. And that's kind of my presentation.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Indeed, there is a very significant risk when anybody gives you money. If your parents give you money, there's usually strings attached. They expect something in return, subtly or not. If a corporation is giving money to a nonprofit, they may ostensibly want to say that we're hands off on the research, we're not going to have any influence. But the fact is, the recipient of that corporate money knows that if they don't come up with a result that is that is what the corporation would like to see, they know they're not going to get another round. So there is always indebtedness. You know, it is not random that Benjamin Franklin said, never a borrower or a lender be. There are strings all along. But I want to particularly talk about you. I think you're really right. Because the knock on nonprofits in previous decades have always been, you know, has been in general, on average, less efficiency. There is a move both in the nonprofit and profit. There is a move in the nonprofit sector to make them run more like a business. That is, be more efficient. And when they do hire business people, the business people tend to be more profit oriented and require bigger salaries. And so, yes, at the top, while top nonprofit salaries do not reach the level of top corporate salaries, certainly six figures is nothing. I mean, they are, you know, heads of significant nonprofits can make $500,000 or even $1 million a year. So yes, that is the point that I think I'm making. That, dear listeners, I'm just trying to encourage more nuance around all of these specific career truths. And one of them simply is, I invite you to view every job opportunity in full dimension. You know, Is it being a corporation a deal killer for you? Is it two strikes against you? Is it one strike against you? Or is it no strikes? Or maybe it may be a plus for some of the reasons, as I pointed out. Companies like the electronics companies that make your TV or radio, or Google that makes information available for free, or Bayer that makes the baby aspirins, and Whirlpool that makes refrigerators, and corporate home builders who make housing much more affordable than individuals can if they're trying to build a house one at a time, or corporate farmers that make food affordable, including organic produce, much more inexpensively than we could get at a farmer's market. I'm simply inviting you to weigh that dispassionately. Let's see. I'll go back to the phones. I guess not. All right. Let me, as I promised, first of all, let our listeners know, listening to Work with Marty and M. Co. Last Wednesday, I gave a speech at UC Berkeley, what they call a public address, where I shared eight career truths that may not be so true. And last week, as a preview, I shared four of those, and the listeners said they wanted to hear the other four, so I'm doing that this week. I've talked about two, and now I'm going to talk about a third. And that is certainly, if there is a ever more popular, quote, truth that people are saying is a truth, is that we should all strive for work-life balance. It's an article of faith. I mean, who could be against balance? I mean, I used the word twice already in this show. I mean, it has its roots in Aristotle, what he called the golden mean. And indeed, bringing things up to today, President Obama and his administration uses the word balanced as a way to describe everything, including the NSA snooping and the balance of security and freedoms. And he used the word balanced to describe the debt, his approach to the debt. And he used the word balanced to describe his approach to illegal immigration. And yet, as I look back on my, now it's hard for me to even say the word, but over 4,000 career clients that I have had the privilege of serving these last 26 years. And I think about my friends and my colleagues, and I think about all those people. Many of the people who feel best about their work life and are most energized overall, who really feel content with their lives and have made the biggest contribution, are people who most people would call as not having work-life balance. They work very long hours. And indeed, a lot of people would denigrate them. They'd call them workaholics. That's a very carefully designed term, workaholic. It's a term that evokes a comparison with alcoholic, someone who's addicted to something bad. But when I reflect on that, is workaholic a fair way to describe a medical researcher who works some nights and some weekends to try some additional experiments? Is workaholic a fair way to describe an outstanding relationship counselor who sees some extra clients each week rather than refer them to a less effective counselor? Is it fair to call somebody a workaholic, somebody addicted to something bad, even if it's an accounts payable clerk who takes the hours 40 to 50, you know, after her regular work week is over, to ensure that everybody gets paid promptly and accurately? Even let's say there's no lofty goal. Let's say she's trying to simply make more money to support her family. I mean, you or I may or may not choose to work long hours, but rather than put people down as out of balance, let alone pathologize them as workaholics, might it be fairer to think of them as hard workers? or even heroes. I mean, some people, they do claim that working long hours is going to cause you to make errors and to burn out. I'm not, certainly, I want to stipulate to this, I'm certainly not advocating, and I think it's really a remarkably stupid practice, the 100-hour work weeks that medical interns have to do. That feels like a fraternity hazing more than anything else. But really, as I do look back on all my clients I've had who were burned out, they were not mainly the people who worked long hours. Indeed, a lot of them worked short hours, but they were at a job that was too hard for them or where the work was unethical. So as you are deciding how many hours you want to devote to work, rather than simply accepting this blanket stricture to strive for work-life balance, I invite you to have more nuance. I invite you to recognize that one size does not fit all, that indeed diversity of lifestyle, diversity of approaches is a wiser approach, in my opinion. So I want you also for yourself, I want you to judge what is the right level of work-life balance for you, also considering your family and also considering the societal impacts of your work. And certainly, I feel real confident about this, think twice or four times before dubbing someone who is a hard worker as, quote, out of balance, let alone somebody who's a workaholic addicted to something bad. I invite you to call again. If you have a reaction to any of these career truths that I'm seeing may not be so true, that is the notion that we should the conventional wisdom and that is perfectly appropriate to sell yourself in landing a job, that in fact there is enough good and bad in all sectors that even the most liberal/progressive among us would be wise to at least consider for-profit work as well as non-profit and government work, and this notion, this other conventional wisdom that everybody should strive for work-life balance should be replaced with some more nuance, and that some people have truly lived the life well led by living a life that is quite out of balance, but not all. I'm curious as to reactions to any of that. You can agree, disagree, amplify, give an example. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. A caller called in and asking for me to list all eight of the eight career truths, and I will do that at the end of the show. Okay. The next of the career truths that may not be so true and require a measure of nuance is that getting a degree is usually a wise bet. And I'll talk about that later, but I really want to make sure that callers get plenty of opportunity to share their perspective. So, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. Hi.
Hi, my name is Madison.
Hi, Madison.
I really love your show, first of all, and I so appreciate everything you have to say. I have to take you to task on this work-life balance thing because I know quite a bit about Workaholics Anonymous, one of the 12-step groups that addresses that. And I think it's very hard to put this in a nutshell, but I'll try and be as brief as I can. Let me turn off my radio there.
Thank you.
Can you hear me okay?
Thank you, Madison.
Everybody is applauding long hours and hard work, and it's become a fanatical American value. Everybody's considered really a hero for doing it. I think when the term workaholic is used, it's a very specific term for people who can't turn it off, who don't have a balance, who are not eating in a balanced way, who don't have outside friendships, whose family lives are destroyed. It's a very serious illness. And it's interesting, out of all the 12-step groups, the Workaholics Anonymous group is one of the smallest groups I've ever seen. So very few people are even willing to admit that they have it as a disease, or that it's destroyed their families or whatever else. So I think that term is really maybe not completely understood. I don't know that you have experience with that. So that was the first point. And the second point was, I think when we talk about work-life balance, all we're trying to do is remind people that there's something besides work. Most of us don't ever achieve work-life balance. We're spending most of our hours in work. And so I think to use that term is to simply remind people, there's leisure, there's a movie, there's your family. It's really just pointing toward, hey, let's round out the picture. I don't think anyone in America gets work-life balance. That's why we're the only nation that has a two-week vacation thing, when in Europe they have 4 weeks or they have 6 weeks. And there's so many studies that have proved that we're not producing anymore with all of this work. And in a sense, we're driving ourselves crazy. And I would love your comments, so I'll stop speaking. But thank you.
You're welcome. There's a lot to say, and I'll try to respond to all of them. First of all, she correctly, it was, of course, not surprising that of all the 12-step programs that she said, the workaholic is the very smallest in terms of members. She's called it a disease. She's saying that there's got to be something beside work. And for many people who, particularly if they don't have very rewarding work, if they can't stop themselves, let's say they are, you know, they have a horrible job. Let's say I'm just saying something like, they are they're toll takers, okay? Which I can't think of as very rewarding. It's repetitive. You're breathing toxic fumes. You're really replaceable by somebody else very easily. And if you insist on, you know, doing overtime, you're already paid quite well. Government workers are paid well, and I mean, they are paid well. And if you insist on working 50, 60, 70 hours a week, probably getting breathing carcinogenic air, and you can't make yourself stop, you know, I would agree that that person could be called, you know, should be certainly encouraged to have more work-life balance. But to describe it broad brush, as the caller did, as a fanatical American value, to call it a broad, wide, pervasive disease that the whole country is guilty of it and everybody is doing it and nobody will ever have it, I think that's too broad brush. As I said, as I look, at least we all live one life through one set of lenses, but I think about the over 4,000 clients who I've had. And also, you know, I am somebody who does, you know, I'm a career counselor. I value work. So at parties and with my friends and whatever, I spend a lot of time disproportionately talking about work. And at least in the end, and I read obsessively about, you know, things related to work. And as I, you know, and I read biographies, the people, there are many exceptions, but here's where we're trying to get nuance. Many people who really feel best about their life, who've made the biggest contribution, and yes, sometimes they don't get the quantity of time with their family. Some of the greatest people who accomplish things, whether it be a famous scientist or an unfamous career counselor or a clerk who works long hours, in general, they feel that the life well led, their life is better led if they spent the extra hours beyond the normal work week seeing another client, writing another article, doing some more work, then hanging out with their family, or to use what the caller said, more leisure, seeing a movie. She says, let's round out the picture. That's kind of one-size-fits-all thinking for many of you, either because you want to or you can't work longer hours, you just burn out, fine. But I'm merely trying to inject a measure of nuance. Contrary to what she says, America right now is not deifying workaholism. We see endless articles in my reading, and I do read obsessively about career things. I've seen 1,000 articles extolling work-life balance. I've not seen one extolling long hours, not one. So to call this a nation that is, you know, fanatical in its embracing of workaholism feels very, very unfair. And yes, again, in the extreme, if you are somebody who's completely ignored, you know, she used the term twice, destroying your family. Well, if it's destroying your family, maybe you do need to cut back, or maybe you also need to educate your family. In some ways, if you feel, you know, I really do believe that work is sacred and has potential to make an enormous difference for the world, even if whether you're a ditch digger or you're a CEO. And I think the wise person who makes the decision to work hours 40 through 60 in work rather than hanging out with family maybe instead of assuming that that has destroyed the family, but rather to explain to the family that he or she is making a decision that the life well led is better spent when there are more spending more hours at work. And I do think it's broad brush to term it a disease, a fanatical American value, that you know, it's everybody needs to round it out so and see a movie, which was her example. And her notion that just because Europe has 4 weeks, much of Europe gives workers 4 or 5 weeks of vacation, whereas in standard America it's more like 2 or 3. Is that intrinsically good? I think we need to look at that moment by moment. Is the week, and it's different again for every individual, but the individual who spends that extra week or three at work rather than on vacation, can one really upfront say is pathological or is clearly that Europe is superior for doing that? I think more nuance is required. And finally, she made a very broad brush statement that all these studies show that that working long hours makes you less productive, less efficient. I have seen some advocates. There are advocacy groups for, and I won't, that have reasons to advocate for people working less hours. For example, there are groups who, for example, who point to France, where there is a 30-hour mandated work week, which enables the amount of work to be done by a society to be distributed more broadly across its populace. Their advocacy for work-life balance is not grounded in what's good for the individual, but they are of an egalitarian belief that it is better to spread the amount of work around to the entire populace than to have more work being done by the, on average, more competent. So, for example, if we take that cardiologist example, there are the best cardiologists are today in America working 70 or 80 hours a week because they're in such demand. People want them because they're brilliant and life-saving. And some of the worst, you know, they're not as good. And so they're maybe working 10 or 20 hours a week to try to just struggle to get, you know, they can only get 10 or 20 hours a week worth of clients. In France, that 70-hour-a-week top cardiologist would be forced to reduce his workload or her workload to 30 hours, and the inferior cardiologist, who may simply have bad bedside manner or may be guilty of malpractice and is terrible, would have more. So there's two schools of thought about this. You know, should we indeed spread the work more broadly across the populace, or should we essentially give more, quote, meritorious people more hours? And that is, you know, what is undergirding this notion of work-life balance often. So again, my message to you is to encourage more nuance. I've made clear 3 or 4 times that my goal is not that everybody should be working long hours, but that in fact, at minimum, we should not denigrate somebody who works hours as somebody who needs fixing, needs a 12-step program, is, quote, is fanatical, is diseased. And those are my points about that. Let's we may or may not get to my final of the 4 points, but I certainly let me take one. No, let me do this because I think let me take one more call. And then I think I may. Yeah, let's take one more call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, my name is Pamela.
Hello, Pamela.
And, hi, I'm an elementary school teacher. And some people think that the teaching profession is an easy one because we get lots of vacations, we get summers off. So I wanted to make 2 comments about what you said about work-life balance. One is that you made mention of people taking additional hours, and most of the things are referred to are positions in which you get paid for those additional hours. Well, teachers don't get paid for the additional hours we work. And anybody who knows teachers or a family member that's a teacher knows, we take, it's just expected of us to work at least 10 hours additionally a week. We take homework home to correct. We do report cards. We have parent conferences. So I just want to mention there are many positions that in which people are expected to do more work for which we're not paid. That's one thing. And then the other thing is I agree with you that sometimes it's just rewarding. I spend a lot of time on the weekends with children. I spend time with the families. That's something that I enjoy. Mm-hmm. So it's a question of whether you're choosing it optionally or whether it's imposed on you.
Okay, thank you very much for the call. Indeed, teachers are indeed like most. There are two categories of employees in America. One are called exempt and one are non-exempt. Non-exempt employees are generally lower level workers who are paid by the hour, and they are required to be given time and a half for overtime beyond 40 hours a week. But most professionals, whether they be teachers or nonprofit executives or managers or corporate people, they don't get paid. They get paid an annual salary, and they are not paid. You know, teachers are not the only ones who are paid the same, whether you work 40 or 70 hours a week. Her other point about whether it's voluntary to work extra hours, if it's more fun. She says she spends more time on the weekends with kids because it's fun. And that's perfectly, of course, a fine voluntary thing to do. But a lot of times people do work more, not because it's more fun, because it feels right. So that cardiologist, I'm sure, would find it more, or not sure, but might well find it more fun to watch a movie or to hike or to play with his or her dog or his family or whatever, but chooses to say, well, it's more important that I cure or try to cure more patients than if I have fun. So fun should not always be considered the only criterion. Certainly, obviously, it's better when one chooses to work long hours. I think it probably, there is an interesting gray area. If an employer has a workplace culture that expects people to work 60 hours a week versus it voluntarily so, again, I think nuance is required. One could, on the one hand, say that's an unfair work demand. On the other hand, one could say different workplace cultures are different. There are some workplace cultures where the expectation is 35 or 37 hours a week, others with 60. As long as there was pretty fair disclosure up front that this is a workplace that values 60 hours, I know myself, if I were looking for a job, I do love to work. I feel almost sacred. I feel like I'm living right livelihood when I'm working. I'm fine with some recreation. I love playing with my wife and my dog and going out to eat and all that stuff. But I feel very, like, right about a hard-working environment. So for me, I wouldn't mind at all, if as long as an employer said, this is what we expect, I wouldn't mind that option. If I was forced into a work environment where everybody could only choose to work 40 and work long hours, and many, many people chose not to, I would consider that not as good. I'd rather work in an environment where everybody was expected to work long hours, so I didn't feel like I was the only one. It felt like a better cultural fit. So in sum, the message is nuanced. We didn't get to the fourth of my of the eight career truths that aren't so true. I'm going to save the last one for next week, but as the caller requested, and I promised that I would list all eight briefly here as a way of just capstoning this hour today. And so the eight are, instead of blithely mouthing the mantra, follow your passion, assess whether for you the risk-reward ratio of trying to get paid well enough to do what you love is wiser than pursuing something with a better risk-reward ratio, maybe an under-the-radar career and pursuing your passion on the side. Second one is, instead of the broad-brush advice to network, 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 look at your track record at networking and your needs and decide how much effort you should put into networking rather than, maybe you want to spend more time getting skilled in your work. The third ostensible career truth is, instead of accepting that when looking for a job you got to sell yourself, consider whether it might be wiser to think of job hunting less as selling and more as matchmaking. We also might want to take a closer look at whether self-employment is as desirable as is widely touted. It's more difficult than many people say. Next one, might we want to revisit the conventional wisdom that you're going to make a bigger difference working for a nonprofit than government, than in the private sector. There is good and bad in all sectors. Instead of blanketly saying that we should all strive for work-life balance, I think we need a more nuanced approach. One's lifestyle doesn't fit all. We should, if we truly celebrate diversity, instead of pathologizing hard workers as workaholics, like alcoholics addicted to something bad, that a fairer description might be hard worker. And the one we didn't get to today is that getting a degree is usually a wise bet. It was one other one, which is that rather than just smugly assert we make our own luck, might we want to feel gratitude for the luck that contributed to our successes and feel a bit more charitable toward those who started out life with fewer of the building blocks for success. I'm sorry I tried to cram it all in. Anyway, never trying to please you. That's Work with Marty Nemco for this week. Thanks to Joanne Marr, my board op, and all of you for listening and calling in. Next Sunday, I will do 3-Minute Career Makeovers on Callers, and I will talk about with UC Berkeley's Jeremy Adam Smith about the practical implications of research on gratitude, altruism, compassion, and mindfulness on one's work life. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.